Hello and welcome to Case Dismissed, a teenager's guide to the Supreme Court. I'm Carter Higgins, and I'm so glad you decided to listen today. In today's episode, I examine the case that established what we know today as the administrative state, the administration and regulation of federal and state government agencies, McCullough versus Maryland. Before one looks at the case, though, they must look at the first Constitution of the Union, the Articles of Confederation, its drastic failures, and the birth of the Supremacy Clause in the Constitution. The failures of the Articles of Confederation culminated and were laid out before the new Union throughout the latter half of 1786 and the birth of 1787. The Articles, the first Constitution of the United States, established neither an executive branch nor judicial branch, created a unicameral one-house legislature with one vote per state, and lacked congressional power to control foreign trade, interstate commerce, levy and collect taxes, or draft a militia. In turn, states created different currencies, leading to confusion and discrepancies among one another, and ultimately led to states acting as their own countries. States imposed tariffs on each other, heightening divides between themselves and undermining the new Union. Only a vague, firm league of friendship, written in the Articles, bound the states together. Because Congress could not raise and support an army, it had to rely on state militias to respond to issues of national precedence. Furthermore, Congress had to ask states for funds, as not it, but they, had the power to tax. But because states thought of themselves as independent, with good reason, as the Articles granted them supremacy over the national government, many refused to financially support the country as a whole. And Massachusetts was feeling the grave effects of this lack of centralized power. Shays Rebellion was an uprising in Massachusetts in response to the state's high taxes and foreclosing of properties. Armed protesters blocked courts from carrying out foreclosures and debt collection processes, eventually shutting down the Springfield Supreme Court. Daniel Shays, one of the rebellion's leaders, eventually led an attack on the federal arsenal in Springfield, which exposed the failures of the Articles. As the national government, if you could even call it that, lacked the authority to raise an army, states were in vain asked to band together to quell the uprising. Finally, wealthy merchants from Boston agreed to raise an army of over 4,000 troops, which successfully put an end to the chaos. Stopping the disaster it did, but the last-minute militia and Shays Rebellion only proved to the 13 states that a constitution, with a strong federal government, was needed to support the Union. In this constitution was, and still is, the Supremacy Clause, which proclaims the Constitution and federal law the supreme law of the land. This provision was to be challenged, though, in the Supreme Court, and so was the Necessary and Proper Clause, which allows Congress to create any legislation that is necessary to carry out its enumerated powers. In 1816, Congress created the Second Bank of the United States. Later, in 1818, the state of Maryland created a law taxing the bank's Baltimore branch. After the bank's cashier, James W. McCullough, refused to pay the tax, Maryland's Court of Appeals held that the Second Bank of the United States was unconstitutional because it did not state explicitly in the Constitution the power to charter the bank. The constitutional questions being asked of the court were, 1. Is Congress's establishing the Second Bank of the United States constitutional or among the implied powers delegated to Congress in the Constitution? And 2. If so, is a state able to tax branches of the federal bank residing within their borders? The court held unanimously, and you'll find that many Marshall Court rulings were, that Congress did not have the power to create the Second Bank of the United States, and that states could not tax it. Authoring and elaborating on the court's unanimous decision, Chief Justice John Marshall stated, quote, "The subject, the Second Bank of the United States, is the execution of those great powers on which the welfare of a nation essentially depends," end quote. Marshall and the court believed establishing the bank among the implied powers of Congress, and that it complied with the Necessary and Proper Clause, which Marshall redefined as legislation, quote, appropriate and legitimate, end quote. The decision reads, furthermore, quote, "Among the enumerated powers, we do not find that of establishing a bank or creating a corporation. But there is no phrase in the instrument which, like the Articles of Confederation, excludes incidental or implied powers, and which requires that everything granted shall be expressly and minutely described," end quote. On the question of states being able to tax the branch, the court argued, quote, "The power to tax is the power to destroy," end quote, and that, quote, "state governments have no right to tax any of the constitutional means employed by the government of the Union to execute its constitutional powers." The impact of McCulloch is crucial because the Supreme Court ruled that, one, among Congress's implied powers is the authority to charter a national bank, and two, states lack the power to tax federal property, solidifying that the federal government, the laws it carries out, and the Constitution as the supreme law of the land, and affirming both the Supremacy Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause. Furthermore, McCulloch was one of the first Supreme Court cases on federal power, and proved that the Marshall Court was not one of public opinion, but one that was bound to the Constitution, and began establishing the principle of what we know today as layer cake federalism, in which the state and federal government work in separate spheres. To talk more about the McCulloch precedent, I invited Professor Kermit Roosevelt of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Specializing in constitutional law, Roosevelt earned his Bachelor of Arts from Harvard University and Juris Doctor from Yale University. So the McCulloch precedent is undoubtedly one of the court's most influential, as it paved the way for what we know today as the administrative state and expanding congressional power under the Necessary and Proper Clause. So with that said, without this case and assuming there were no other cases like it, what would you think the United States would look like today?
So as far as substantive constitutional law goes, what McCulloch stands for is this expansive vision of federal power. So if McCulloch had gone the other way, and that was our baseline for how much power the federal government has, It would certainly be a very different country. We wouldn't have the pervasive federal regulation of the economy that we have. We wouldn't have the administrative state. We wouldn't have things like the Food and Drug Administration. Mm-hmm. It's also important to understand, of course, though, that the transformation in federal-state relations has a lot to do not just with McCulloch, but also with the Civil War and Reconstruction and a new vision of the relationship between the states, the federal government, and the people.
And just to add on, I think that this is a generalization, but I think that when we look to the superficial facts of cases, I think a lot of people tend to think that Marbury is the court's most important case just because it established judicial review. But then when they think of McCulloch, I think many people the importance of it is maybe harder to see superficially just because people might think, oh, just the Second Bank of the United States, what's the importance? But I think myself included, when you look further into the case and look at the subsequent cases that follow, it's not just the bank, and it's about the expansion of national power. And it's interesting to see if Marshall had not acted as he did, which will come up in my next question. I wonder how cases like Gibbons v. Ogden and the expansion of the Commerce Clause, how they would turn out. So that's just an interesting perspective to think of. And my second question is about Marshall's actions. So we see in Marbury, Marshall says
that he's strictly bound to the written words of the Constitution in declaring the provision which allowed Marbury to bring his writ of mandamus straight to the Supreme Court unconstitutional because it expanded the court's original jurisdiction. And his decision seems like somewhat of a mechanistic process. And in McCulloch, we see Marshall reasoning that the Constitution must be interpreted generously and that the words don't speak for themselves. And so, as we know, he goes as far to redefine the necessary and proper clause, deeming it legislation that's appropriate and legitimate. So what do you think accounts for this somewhat of a change in his philosophy between Marbury and McCulloch?
I think the answer there is that McCulloch is a good example of constitutional interpretation for reasons that I might go into more depth on later. And Marbury is really a bad faith partisan manipulation. So I hate Marbury. I think it's a terrible decision. I have an article actually on McCulloch and Marbury that I'd be happy to send you if you're interested in it. Because in Marbury, basically what's going on is Marshall is trying to advance the interests of the Federalist Party against Jefferson's Democratic Republicans. And the way that he can do that is by strengthening the power of the judiciary. So it's sort of about separation of powers within the federal government.
Yeah.
So he lays down this marker about judicial review, which, you know, actually doesn't do that much. If Marbury hadn't been decided, people had talked about judicial review before. The most memorable lines in Marbury are actually basically stolen from one of Hamilton's Federalist Papers. So it didn't really break new ground substantively. What it did that was sort of alarming, I think, and the reason that I don't like it, is that first it kind of twists the language of the Judiciary Act to manufacture a conflict with the Constitution. And then second, it resolves that purported conflict without any thought to the idea that other people, like the members of Congress who drafted the Judiciary Act, might have thought about these constitutional issues and might have had some insight into them. So it acts as though the court is the only relevant actor. Whereas in McCulloch, you can see there are two different constitutional questions presented. One is, does Congress have the authority to do this? And the other is, can Maryland tax the bank? And he pays a lot of attention to whether he should defer to what Congress thinks and whether he should defer to what Maryland thinks, and reaches different conclusions and explains why and gives you actually pretty persuasive justifications for why he thinks on questions like this, it's okay to trust Congress, but it's not okay to trust Maryland.
Yeah, and my last guest, because my first episode was on Marbury, he was saying that Marshall's opinion was quite partisan and bashed the Jefferson administration. So thank you for that elaboration on what my last guest started to talk about. And so my last question is, as my AP government class will hopefully use this podcast as a resource before the exam in freshening up their skills about each of the required cases, could you sum up McCulloch versus Maryland and its importance in a synthesizing sentence or a few synthesizing sentences?
Yeah, sure. So there are, I would say, two really important things about McCulloch v. Maryland. One is, as far as substantive constitutional law goes, it does have this vision of expansive federal power and judicial deference to assertions of federal power. So the idea there is someone has the authority to do this in our system. Either it's the federal government or the states. And Congress thinks they have the power to do it. And, you know, we might as well trust them on that, because if we make a mistake, the only thing that happens is the federal government is doing something that could have been left to the states. But he says the federal and state governments are equally representatives of the people. So maybe the cost of making that mistake isn't that high. This isn't an individual rights case. He says it's not one where the great principles of liberty are involved. So there's a vision that Congress has broad powers and the court is going to be deferential to Congress. The other important thing about Marbury, and what I think is more important, and the reason, sorry, about McCulloch, the thing that I think is more important and the reason that I start my constitutional law course with it is that it shows you something about judicial review, because you have these two different constitutional questions. Does Congress have the power to do this? And can Maryland tax the bank? And McCulloch gives you an analysis of those that tells you why here you can trust the federal government and you can't trust the states. Mm-hmm. And in this vision of sort of defects in the state political process that might make them not weigh everyone's interests appropriately, McCulloch is actually a forerunner of the later Warren Court jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. And I think it's deeply insightful there, whereas Marbury is just garbage, basically.
Yeah. Well, that's all the questions I have. Just thank you so much again for joining me. And thank you for your perspective on the case.
Yeah, sure. So would you like this article? I mean, it's a little bit long and maybe technical, but parts of it could be interesting.
Yes, please. Yeah, I was doing some research and I found it, but I think it would be easier if you could send it to me just because I think I'd have to download it. But
okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Bye. Bye.
Now, this brings us to the end of the second episode of Case Dismissed, A Teenager's Guide to the Supreme Court. I hope you now have a good understanding of another landmark Supreme Court case, and if you already knew about it, I hope you gained a new perspective from Professor Roosevelt about the far-reaching effects of the McCulloch precedent. Stay tuned for the next episode on Gibbons v. Ogden and the debate and expansion of the Commerce Clause.